sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Carol Myers, the famed archaeologist and author of a new book on women in the time of the Bible. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and almost Chag Sameach. Tomorrow night we begin Passover, the great festival of freedom, the single most observed Jewish festival of the entire year, edging out Hanukkah in the latest polls. Nearly three-quarters of all American Jews will attend a Passover Seder of some kind, and within that Seder there are many lovely and wonderful interpretations on how to express freedom through prayer, story, ritual, song, and food. Passover is both the most Jewish of holidays and the most universal. It's so Jewish because, more than any other part of our people's lives, it focuses on the two most important elements in many Jews' experiences, food and education. The Seder itself is a set of ritual foods turned into profound pedagogy, but it is also part of the complex joy of joining extended family and friends in a meal in which every part plays a crucial role. What could be more Jewish than finding meaning in every bite of food, each sip of wine? Teaching through food. Nothing is more Jewish. And while most of the menu and the main symbols and the structure of the Pesach experience remain the same, after all, Seder means order, so we don't vary the pattern much. The actual ways we explore each of the elements of the Haggadah, the telling of the Passover story, are open to interpretation, addition, and reflection. Just as my wife, Wendy, typically tries to cook a new dish or dessert each year, so too, I always introduce a few new elements into my own family's Seder every year, and I do so at the communal Seder we celebrate at Temple on the second night of Pesach, that's this coming Tuesday as well. While most people remember the delicious food best, the truth is that what makes a Seder special is the mix of insight and personal involvement and investment from the guests. What they remember about Passover growing up, or their most memorable Pesach, or what freedom means to them today. It is these personal experiences that make Seder special. And of course, good music at the Seder really helps. One of the consistent highlights of our unique Two Jewish blend of entertainment, education, controversy, humor, and news, a kind of Jewish radio charoset, if you will, a mix of delectable elements that is so much more than the sum of its various parts, has always been Jewish music of all kinds. In that spirit, and the spirit of the Passover season, we continue our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music with the wonderful Sephardic version of the Passover song Who Knows One, Echad Mi Yodea, Ken Supiense, as sung by the Sephardic Israeli star Yehoram Gaon.
Ken Supiense, Entendiense, Alavar al Dio Criense, Qualo es el uno, Qualo es el uno. Uno es el Criador, Uno es el Criador, Uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, cuáles son los dos, cuáles son los dos, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creyense, cuáles son los siete, cuáles son los siete. Siete días con el Shabbat, seis días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador, uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo.
That was Yehoram Gaon, the Israeli star, singing Who Knows One. From the end of the Passover Seder, Yehoram Gaon became famous in the movie Casablanca way back in 1974. My bar mitzvah year, a mere 39 years ago or so. Ouch. Anyway, while all Jewish holidays provide wonderful opportunities for Jewish music, Pesach is particularly rich in both melodic possibilities and the varieties of musical types you can feature, both serious and silly, in the spirit of a holiday that is both profoundly serious. After all, what could be more powerful than celebrating freedom from oppression and praying for the liberation of those who are enslaved? But it's also fun and sometimes silly. Here's one of my favorite takes on just what matzah is. It's from The Smoothie, Eric Schwartz.
I feel like a freak, because every time I pull out something to eat, but it's weak, I can't do this, because I'm Jewish, and I can't eat bread. Yeah, my rabbi said only
matzah.
Any way you want to eat it, cold or hot, it's
matzah.
Fun for your mother, brother, sister, father,
matzah.
Buy in bulk for a lower cost per box, it's
matzah, 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 matzah.
Hanukkah, no, that's over, so you don't get passed over. Get your ass over to my pad, it's Passover. I'm the mad flow, a smoothie, and I hope you understand it. If you want the story of Passover, rent the Ten Commandments starring Charlton Heston. But I got a question about the bread that is unleavened, causing indigestion called
matzah.
Eat it for a week, we got stuh. No bread, no pasta. Best believe a Jew is stopped. Now Moses made the matzah when he was fleeing Egypt. Had no time for bread to rise, he said, I just leave it, we can eat it like this, feed it to the Hebrews. But little did he know that the weight would end up equal, cause
let my people go
became the anthem. Get your damn hands up, maybe it will help you pass some. How could one bread rock it so famous when the taste is the same flavor of the box it came in?
Matzah.
When I munch, I love the crunch of
matzah.
I love it a bunch, wash it down with punch.
Matzah.
What's for lunch? I got a hunch, it's
matzah,
matzah,
matzah, matzah.
That was Eric Schwartz talking about matzah on Passover, which we are commanded to eat at Seder. A whole sheet of matzah in order to fulfill the commandment to eat unleavened bread, as our ancestors did. You know, the Seder is a complete immersion in the ways of understanding freedom through words, songs, stories, foods, touch, taste, smell, even physical activity. Everything about the Seder has layers of meaning and purpose, and I like nearly everything about the Pesach Seder. Except one thing. Matzah. Now, many of you have heard me rant over the years about matzah, the true bread of affliction. It's dry, tasteless, a bread we eat only because our ancestors didn't have enough time to let bread rise in the haste of their exodus from their 400 years of slavery in Egypt. Personally, I can't stand matzah, and I never eat it except on Passover. To me, it is the anti-food and tastes very much like the cardboard box it comes in. I have heard all the excuses for matzah. It's great with butter and salt on it, and it doesn't take any attention away from the foods you put on it. Also, you can use matzah for months without it going stale because it tastes stale to start with. All of those arguments work equally well, explaining why we should eat newsprint or sawdust, which tastes kind of like matzah, I expect. I'll eat matzah on Pesach because I'm supposed to, and I'm a Jew, and of course a rabbi, and I have no choice. Otherwise, ugh. You know something, though? There's an even less flavorful version of matzah available. It's called shmura matzah, meaning carefully watched to make sure that no leavening gets in at any stage of the growing and creating process. Apparently, shmura matzah makes sure that no flavor gets in, too. It's much more expensive than regular matzah, by the way. Apparently, there's an inverse relationship between taste and cost on matzah for Pesach. We use shmura matzah for Seder, you know, to be extra kosher, I suppose. Well, there is one good side to eating matzah. It makes maror, the bitter herbs, taste pretty good by comparison. At least they have flavor. When we come back on Too Jewish this pre-Passover morning, we'll meet our guest, Carol Myers, the outstanding archaeologist whose new book is called Rediscovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context. It explores what the life of women was really like in the time of the Bible, not as the movies show. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at J. Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. I'm delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Carol Myers, the extraordinarily distinguished professor from Duke University, who is both an extraordinary archaeologist and has written extensively on women in the biblical period. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what do we not know about women in the period of the Bible that we ought to know?
A lot. That's the short answer. The long answer is that for generations, most people relied on materials in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, for information. And that's there are a lot of problems with using that as the only source. I can give you just a couple of them. The Bible is androcentric. It focuses mainly on men and not on women. It's a public kind of document, and it deals with public affairs, with the affairs of kings and priests and prophets and wise men, and has very little to say about ordinary people, men and women, I would say. It's not just women that ordinary women that are overlooked. It's ordinary men as well. Something like only 25% of the names of women in the Hebrew Bible are women's names. Most of the names, most of the people, most of the characters are men. So there's not a lot of information about women, and the women that are there are extraordinary women. They're like Deborah or Miriam. They're unusual and atypical. And the legal materials, which look pretty negative about women in the Pentateuch and the Chumash, those materials are geared towards an elite, landed fraction of society. They are not about the masses of people who were the non-elites, the 90% or the 97%, to use today's terminology.
I remember that poem, Young Alexander Conquered India, He Alone, I think it's Brecht. Obviously, the common people were the vast majority of the people in biblical times. Women are often known just as the wife of somebody or the daughter of somebody. You don't even get a name. How do you extrapolate from that whole stories?
You don't. I mean, those are lineages, patrilineages. Their land was passed from generation to generation along the male line. And that's why the reckoning in the biblical genealogies is by male lineages. Just as you said, so-and-so, son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so. Occasionally in the genealogies, you'll find a woman's name. It will say so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, and then it'll give his mother. But those are just ways, usually, of signaling something extra important about the person in the lineage, especially for the tribe of Judah, which is the most important biblical tribe. They tend to throw in a few women here and there.
We will talk much more with Professor Carol Myers and discover what we can learn about women in the Bible, among other things, when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows, streaming them from the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Judaism is a religion filled with remarkable tradition, and Passover is a holiday that has more tradition than any other time of year. One of the lesser-known aspects of Pesach prep is the custom of searching for and burning the last few bits of leavened products left in our homes the night and morning prior to the Passover Seder, tonight and tomorrow, for those of you observing Pesach fully. The removal of leavened stuff, that is bread, cereal, pastry, any byproducts or crumbs of those foods, has really taken place already over the last few weeks of preparation for Pesach. But the ritual of Bedikat Chametz, the search for the last few crumbs, is always done on the last night before Pesach. That is, tonight. It works like this. You take a candle and a feather, no kidding, we still do it this way, and probe the last few corners of your home that are unexplored, which might harbor a leftover bit of bread, a cracker, or candy. If you have young kids at home, it's fun to plant a few pieces wrapped in plastic or foil for them to find. You gather it all together then and declare that you have nothing left that you shouldn't have over Passover, and if there's anything there, you didn't mean it. The next morning, before noon, you collect the leavened stuff, what we call in Hebrew chametz, and burn it outside the house. It's called biur chametz, and it's a wonderful opportunity for the closet pyromaniacs among us to have fun. When I lived in Jerusalem, the ritual of Biur Chametz was really something to see. The morning before Passover, there are small fires burning on all the street corners in Yerushalayim, with Jerusalemites gleefully tossing their last pieces of bread or pastry onto small pyres. It's a festive atmosphere focused on removing impurity from the home, getting ready for the great Pesach festival. You know, President Obama should have stuck around in Jerusalem to see that. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi, and soon Pesach Sameach.
Chag Pesach Sameach v'kasher. A happy holiday of Pesach. Let's talk about Passover in Israel. It's a vacation week for Israelis.
It's a vacation week. Actually, kids get 3 weeks vacations because traditionally the kids were supposed to help out at home to clean for Passover. You know, my mother always used to say that one of the reasons we're cleaning for Passover is that we'll feel exactly like the Jews,
the slaves,
the slaves in Egypt. That's part of the point. But you know, Passover also have a very strong Zionistic theme to it. It's the holiday where we truly mark the concept of freedom, and to much degree, the idea of having a Jewish state in the land of Israel is the idea of having, of being a free people in our land. To some degree, that Israel today is the only place on earth where Jewish people can truly be free people in our land. I know that might sound a little provocative, and maybe some American Jews might say, oh, what are you talking about? We're really free here in the U.S. We have all the freedom we'd like. But, you know, only when you're a sovereign country, when you are the one making the shots, making the decisions, being the government, do you understand fully what true freedom is. Because true freedom is not the teenage style of a freedom of going out and having parties. True freedom is the adult, more mature element of freedom, of taking responsibility, of needing to run a state, needing to manage your own people, making decisions based on Jewish ethics for better and worse. And Israel today is the only implementation we have of that worldwide. And I think that's the main Zionistic element of Passover when we think of Israel. It's
really chofesh, the idea of being chirut, real, actual, national freedom, that concept of sovereignty. That's a great point, which I think that most of us sort of miss in thinking about being slaves and then being free. But real freedom only comes when you have the ability to make collective decisions for your nation.
Am chofshi be'artzenu, a free people in our nation.
Like we sing in HaTikva.
Exactly.
Guy, may you have, also we say in Yiddish, a zisen Pesach, a nice, enjoyable, delightful, free Passover.
Yeah, I'm going to make my matzah gebrai.
Oh, you'll have to share some.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Pesach.
Chag Sameach. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning in honor of the Festival of Pesach that begins tomorrow night comes from the wonderful poet Marge Piercy, a three-time guest of Two Jewish, and her evocative poem Matzah, maybe the best of her whole Pesach cycle. Flat you are as a doormat and as homely. No crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow. You break with a snap. You are dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter. You are bumpy as a mud basin in a drought. Square as a slab of pavement, you have no inside to hide raisins or seeds. You are pale as the full moon, pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste, in the mouth you promise home. That was the terrific poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for the Pesach Seder table. First Seder is tomorrow night, March 25th. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jewish tendency to kvetch and complain about all the dangers to our people all over the world and how awful it is, and not to realize all the great aspects of Judaism, both of being Jewish today and of Jewish life. So how do we teach people to kvell instead of just complaining, kvetching about them kvetching?
Well, it's a key question, I think, because in some ways I feel like the future of the Jewish people depends on finding an answer to this question. How do you get a more affirmative form of identity than simply an endless recitation of past wrongs committed against us and our grievances and how often we were victims and how almost every holiday seems the same, with the exception of, right, and if we think about like the Sukkot.
Just Thanksgiving, no
Shavuot.
Fetching. Yeah.
Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. I mean, these are holidays that
Yom Kippur, you have a whole martyrology in the service, which talks about all the past wrongs. So
yeah, that's
not
true.
So sure.
But it doesn't commemorate an attempt. I mean, Yom Kippur itself is not an attempt to
right. It's not like Yom
exterminate
Shoah
us.
Or
right.
Oh, I agree.
So I'm thinking of my experiences in Jewish communities around the world and realizing that some of them are even more this way than we are. I mean, certainly the Jewish communities in Europe have heavily guarded synagogues. They spend a lot of their budgets on security, way more than we do.
Very hard to get in. You need your passport. You have to call ahead a lot of times.
Jewish schools, even more so. These places seem like armed fortresses very often. And obviously that calls to mind a sense of suffering and victimization. So do they do a better job of affirming the positive? Maybe, because it may be that in a place like Germany or France or some other place that has a long history of anti-Semitism, when Jews do celebrate in the form of a bar mitzvah or a wedding or some happy occasion, there's more of a sense of in your face, you know, blah, 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 kid sort of thumbing his nose at the former persecutors. We're still here. But that's not really what we're getting at when we talk about Kfeling. It's not the sense that we're still here. It's mastering Jewish knowledge, Jewish skills, Jewish ways of doing certain things, and spending the time and effort and the intellectual energy to do that. So how do we effect that paradigm shift?
You know, the phrase that comes to mind is celebrating Judaism. You know, enjoying all the wonderful aspects, the holiness, the commitment to justice, and the great festival experiences that we can have. And by the way, the food's pretty good, too.
Right. But if you want to celebrate, you have to know what it is you're celebrating. There's an aspect of you have to acquire knowledge. This is always what Judaism was about, was the acquisition of Torah, often for its own sake, just studying as being, there is a rabbinic saying, as you know better than I, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, that the study of Torah is as important as all the other commandments put together. So this goes against what most people think. Most people think like, well, the Ten Commandments, don't murder, don't, but Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, that you should study. It's a positive injunction. And the question is, how many people who avidly follow the internet for signs of persecution actually do spend that time studying and learning Torah, learning Talmud, learning whatever?
Not enough.
So how do we change that? How do we change the paradigm?
Well, and I think part of it is making it available, and part of it is making it exciting, and part of it is just being proud of that aspect of Judaism instead of saying, oh, yeah, Torah, we'll ignore the sermon, we'll ignore the text. We make it clear that that's really important and that people need to understand that. And we don't even really sell it a lot of times now.
And I think we need to do it also in a way that's joyful.
Absolutely. We will joyfully return next week. Thanks very much, Tom, and Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Same to you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish Humor Your Bubby and Zadie Knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service, especially for Passover this week in acknowledgement of all the preparations. Once upon a time, in a faraway land, a king lived who had a Jewish advisor. The king relied so much on the wisdom of his Jewish advisor that one day he elevated him to head advisor. After it was announced, however, the other advisors objected. They said it was bad enough just to sit in council with a Jew, but allow one to be the lord over them was too much to bear. Being a compassionate ruler, the king agreed and ordered the Jew to convert. What could he do? A Jew had to obey the king, and so he did. As soon as the act of conversion was done, the Jew felt great remorse for this terrible decision. As the days became weeks, his remorse turned to despondency, and as months passed, his depression took a toll on his physical health. He became weaker and weaker. Finally, he could stand it no longer. His mind was made up. He burst in on the king and cried, I was born a Jew, and a Jew I must be. Do what you want with me, but I can no longer deny my faith. The king was surprised. He had no idea the Jew felt so strongly about it. Well, if that's how you feel, he said, the other advisors will have to learn to live with it. Your counsel is too important to me to do without. Go, be a Jew again, he said. The Jew was elated. He hurried home to tell the good news to his family. Strength surged back into his body. Finally, he burst into the house and called out to his wife, Rivka, Rivka, we can be Jews again, we can be Jews again. But his wife only glared back at him angrily and said, you couldn't wait till after Pesach? You see, there's so much preparation and cleaning and cooking and preparing and... never mind. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and have a Chag Pesach Sameach, a happy holiday of Passover. And now a word of Torah. This week's portions are chosen especially for reading on the holiday of Passover. In addition to the usual suspects, the plagues, the Passover sacrifice, the crossing of the Sea of Reeds, the washing away of the Egyptian army and its chariots, the song at the sea, there is one unusual special Torah reading, and we'll chant it this coming Shabbat, Saturday. It's from the portion of Ki Tisa in Exodus, and it includes one of the most mystical and puzzling sections of the whole Torah. Moses asks that God's presence be revealed to him directly, and God replies, you shall not see my face and live. You shall not see my face and live. The power and presence of the divine is too much for even the greatest of our ancestors to be allowed to fully encounter it. God invites, well, commands, really, Moses to hide his own face in the cleft of a rock, and then God allows the divine presence to pass behind Moses. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu, our great teacher Moses, who supposedly knows God panim el panim, face to face, actually only gets the back of God. That's not to imply that God moons Moses. Although we are created, B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, we don't tend to think that we are somehow subject only to the flippancy of the Lord. No, this curious passage teaches a lesson. We are not going to be saved by gazing at God's face, by the direct experience of God's intent. Our way is more complex, more subtle, more challenging, perhaps more beautiful. We have the responsibility to seek God's presence in the world, to find the God traces that are everywhere, if we can make ourselves aware enough to look for them. Then we will truly see God's face in the faces of our fellow human beings. When we come back on Too Jewish, archaeologist, author, and professor Carol Myers will tell us what the lives of women were like in the time of the Bible when we return on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Barack Obama visited Israel last week, his first visit since being elected president 4.5 years ago, his third visit to Israel overall, and the fifth U.S. president, sitting president, to go to Israel. President Obama was greeted with the strains of Jerusalem of Gold, the lovely anthem of the 67 Six-Day War, and a subtle reminder that the real capital of Israel, for 45 years, is still not recognized as such by the United States. Obama's visit has been a huge story in Israel, and it's pretty big here as well. On his arrival, he hugged both President Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and restated the strong U.S. strategic partnership with Israel, adding,
this is my third visit to Israel, so let me just say, Tov lehiyot shuv baharetz.
It's always good to use a little of the local language in a speech in a foreign country, no? Obama declared that the U.S.-Israel alliance is eternal, la netzach, which is always nice to hear. What we see about the president's visit to the Holy Land and the Jewish state is mostly the ceremonial aspects. What will matter more is what goes on behind closed doors with Israeli leaders and politicians, including new cabinet ministers like Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, rising stars on the Israel political scene who have never met Obama before. This is a historic visit, of course, the first foreign trip of Obama's second term. What it will mean long term is anybody's guess. Israeli-U.S. relations are extremely close now, regardless of the personal relationship or lack of same between the president and the prime minister, and the issues that are likely to be addressed on this trip, Iran's nuclear capability, the brutal civil war in Syria, the instability in all the Arab regimes that neighbor Israel, Israel's building in the West Bank, Palestinians, and so on, are unlikely to alter much about that relationship. But it's good to see the president in Israel. In a follow-up to a sad story, Julio Acevedo, the driver of the car that killed a young Hasidic couple in Brooklyn on their way to the hospital to give birth, was charged with manslaughter. Brooklyn prosecutors announced a second-degree manslaughter charge against Acevedo, who is 44 years old last week. If convicted, he faces life imprisonment. He had earlier been indicted on charges of leaving the scene of a fatal accident. Prosecutors say Acevedo was speeding through the streets of Williamsburg at nearly 70 miles an hour when the BMW he was driving plowed into the livery cab transporting Nachman and Razi Glauber, both 21 years of age, to the hospital early on March 3rd. Razi Glauber was pregnant with their first child. It briefly survived an emergency C-section but died the next day. The Glaubers were killed instantly. Acevedo fled the scene of the accident, was arrested several days later in Pennsylvania. According to reports, Acevedo was previously imprisoned for a decade for first-degree manslaughter, robbery, and drug possession. In February of this year, he was arrested for drunk driving, but the judge did not suspend his license. In other news, the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association has elected an openly gay rabbi to lead the National Rabbinic Organization for the first time. Rabbi Jason Klein, executive director of Hillel at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County, was elected to lead the RRA during its 39th annual convention in New Orleans, which ended last week. It is the first National Rabbinic Association of one of the major Jewish denominations, if you consider Reconstructionist Judaism major, to be led by a gay man. Klein was ordained in 2002, graduated from Columbia in 1997. He grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, and spent 4 years as a congregational rabbi in Long Island. Coming out and growing into my adult Jewish identity would not be the same were it not for affirming teachers, rabbis, and other mentors along the way, Klein said. I am honored to be able to give back by supporting colleagues. We're creating welcoming communities in hundreds of settings across North America and beyond. Pope Francis I is the new pontiff of the Catholic Church, and the heads of the Jewish agencies in his native Argentina have all said that as Cardinal Jorge Maria Bergoglio, he was committed to building bridges to the Jewish community long before he was elected pope. Jewish leaders expect to have a great relationship with him. As a bishop and then cardinal, the pope participated in many interfaith meetings. He was praised by the Jewish community in Argentina for his compassionate response to the 1994 bombing in Buenos Aires of the AMIA, the seven-story building housing the Jewish Community Center and the Argentine Jewish Mutual Association. As a cardinal, he preached in a synagogue twice, spoke at Holocaust commemorations, and visited Israel. Fascinatingly, the only book written by the new pope, currently in print, is a dialogue in Spanish between the then Cardinal Bergoglio and a rabbi, Sobre el Cielo y la Tierra, regarding heaven and earth. It's structured as a transcript of a conversation between Cardinal Bergoglio and Rabbi Abraham Skorka, the rector of the Seminario Rabbinico Latinoamericano, the conservative rabbinical and cantorial training seminary in Buenos Aires. Skorka occupies the pulpit made famous by Rabbi Marshall Meyer. The book skips quickly through discussions of God, fundamentalism, sin, homosexuality, capitalism, money, the poor, and many other topics. The future pontiff addresses the role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust, Argentina's dirty war, and the Mideast conflict in an unscripted way that couldn't be further from the carefully crafted messages that emerge from the Vatican. Because of its insights into the new pope's thinking, Sobre el Cielo y la Tierra has shot to the number one slot for books on religion on Amazon. In this book with the rabbi, in which both men encourage interfaith amity, the pope shows his familiarity with Judaism and Jewish writers, especially Abraham Joshua Heschel, and takes pains to discuss the Holocaust and its impact on the Catholic Church in great detail. Bergoglio says that the great question we must all ask about the Holocaust is not where was God, but where was man? The great powers just washed their hands. They knew much more than they said they did, the new Francis I says. The future pope also agrees in the book wholeheartedly with the need to open up the church's archives on the Holocaust years and unequivocally stresses the importance of clarifying the historical record. If Pope Francis follows up on this, it will help Jewish organizations push for a speedy opening up of these crucial archives. The then cardinal discussed the role of anti-Semitism in his homeland of Argentina, conceding he had less contact with Jews than others, but insists that bigotry and anti-Semitism have decreased markedly over the years. I did not have the same experience as John Paul II of having half my friends Jewish, but I have Jewish friends, he says. Yes, there were some anti-Semitic Catholics, and today there are also some, but not with the virulence of the 1930s, where there's some ecclesiastic anti-Semitism. Today, the politics of the Argentinian church is clear: interreligious dialogue. And that seems very likely to be one of the missions of the new Pope Francis as well, which is good for the Jews and the entire world. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. She's Professor Carol Myers, the distinguished archaeologist, author, scholar, and professor from Duke University, who has a wonderful new book out about women in the Bible, about really rediscovering women in the Bible. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, where the book came from and the title as well?
Well, let me first explain that it's not really about women in the Bible. Those are
women in the biblical period. Yes,
these are women in the biblical period, and most of the women in the Bible are not part of the majority of 90 to 98% farm women, peasant women, who never or rarely appear in the pages of Scripture. The whole idea of this book was to try to find them. They're basically invisible in the Bible, but they're certainly non-existent. They're all over the place in social reality. So using not only hints here and there in the Bible, but also archaeology, the excavation of Israelite dwellings to try to find out a lot more about how people lived, from which we can reconstruct men's and women's roles, and then using anthropology to kind of, or ethnography more specifically, to try to see what the dynamics of household life is like or would have been like by looking at similar cultures that can still be observed. So the idea was to put all these different kinds of material together to and intersect them to try to depict daily life for ordinary folks, and I was focusing, of course, on women. But let me add that the title, Rediscovering Eve, has the name in it of the famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, first lady of the Bible, Eve, the partner of Adam in the creation story. And she's perhaps the most misunderstood of all biblical women. And my thesis is that she really represents every woman, ordinary women. And I go through a detailed analysis of the Garden of Eden story to try to pull away all the kind of post-biblical layers that most of us are familiar with without even realizing that these are perspectives that aren't there in the Bible itself.
You know, it's an amazing story. Just as Adam is human, right? The most basic kind of description, man coming out of the dirt. Chava, Eve is life. And
the Jewish perspective is a little different, even with all of those midrashic layers, than the Christian perspective on Eve. Can you, did you have to kind of cut away one and then the other? How do you get back to an original reading?
Well, I try not to look at the post-biblical Jewish and Christian perspectives either way, at all. And she, it, I would say that even though the Jewish interpretive tradition is somewhat different than the Christian one, they're both pretty negative about Eve. And
sure.
And the earliest mention of Eve outside the Bible, outside the Hebrew Bible, is in a 3rd to 2nd century BCE book called Ecclesiasticus, or Ben Sira, the Wisdom of Ben Sira.
Right.
And in that, Eve, she's not mentioned by name, but there's a line that goes something like this. From the beginning, there was sin, and woman brought it along. In other words, it's clear that the attribution to Eve of the beginnings of sin is a very negative tradition that goes back to the earliest Second Temple Judaism. So that is part and parcel of both Jewish and Christian post-biblical tradition. Eve gets blamed. And there are all kinds of things in the post-biblical tradition that are simply not in the text. Let me just get started with a pretty benign example that's not really about Eve, but I ask my students, I teach a course on this, and I ask my students, what's the fruit in the Garden of Eden? This is before they've even read their homework, their assignment. And they say apple. And I said, well, find that for me in the text. And of course it's not in the text. The text says fruit. Simply fruit. But
I have to tell you, my wife and I have had this discussion. She's sure it's a peach.
Oh, well,
some people say it's just such a luscious, delicious fruit. Yeah, of course.
But, you know, post-biblical tradition has it as apple. Milton's Paradise Lost. That's why your wife knows it. She's an English professor. It has it as an apple. So we are so sure from all this exposure to later tradition about what's in the text that we assume things about it and don't look. So Eve is not a seductress. The word sin never appears in the story.
Nope.
There is no sign that she does anything worse than Adam does. And as a matter of fact, what they do was not all that bad compared to what their kids do a generation later.
Well, immediately, actually.
Yeah.
Nothing
so,
like a little,
so
you know.
She's not the disreputable character that our Western Jewish Christian traditions make her out to be.
How does archaeology play into this kind of exploration?
Well, the archaeology plays, mainly, I guess I would say, into the way we can reconstruct the lives of Eve as every woman, as a representative of average women. And we've excavated, not me personally, but we archaeologists in general have excavated quite a few dwellings from the Iron Age, which would be the period of the Hebrew Bible before the exile, from the 12th to the 6th century BCE. And we see that people lived in simple, what we would call farmhouses, but not elaborate the way our farmhouses are often today. Very small, very self-contained, and usually part of a compound of a couple houses that constituted an extended family. And other amazing sets of some artifacts that women use that have survived. There are a lot, of course, of perishable things, organic things, which haven't survived. But one of the best kinds of artifacts that we do have are grinding tools. That is, people couldn't go out and buy a loaf of bread in the grocery store. How did they get bread, which accounted for as much as 70 or 80% of their caloric intake a day? They never ate meat except on chagim, on holidays. And this bread was the staff of life, just as tradition has it. So they grew wheat grain, and the grain then had to be, after the seeds were put in jars, the grain had to be ground so that the outer husks, which are basically indigestible, were pulled off, and you would get the flour. This process could take a couple hours a day. Can you imagine us today spending 2 to 3 hours a day making bread? But that was part and parcel of women's life. Now, grinding is very labor-intensive and time-consuming. And it's best done in traditional societies when women from neighboring households do it together so that they can sing, no Oprah to listen to.
no entertenment, no, really, at all.
They were each other's entertainment.
Music and some singing,
so
maybe.
Tedious work in traditional societies that takes a long time is almost always done by people working next to each other. Now, the significance of this is just amazing when I started reading the ethnography on this. The significance of this is that women get to know each other. They get to know what's going on in the village. They have kind of a, as one ethnographer put it, an X-ray vision of their whole small village, which may have had no more than 50 people in it. And they're the ones who know what's going on. We might call it gossip today, but that's kind of a pejorative term, and I would never use that gossip. They learn important information, and therefore women become a kind of social network. And if there's one family where there's a struggle, where somebody's sick, they provide the help. If a husband of one of these women has hurt himself and can't plow, they're the ones who will send an older son to help. In other words, they become a kind of communication network and a social safety valve. They're the ones who provide the first aid and the resources. There's no government agencies to take care of these things. So the role of women in the fabric of society and holding it together is extremely important. And that's the kind of thing that we can reconstruct using archaeology and ethnography, and that we would really never guess without having those kinds of tools. The Bible alone maybe has one or two hints of this, which I can tell you about, but on the basis of them alone, we wouldn't get it.
You know, I've always been compelled by certain specific women characters. Again, they're the heroines, right? They're the matriarchs, Deborah. The character I find in some ways the most interesting is Rebecca, biblically speaking, in which not only do you get really a tremendous amount of character, but you get a whole bunch of daily life aspects. In exploring women, is it useful to look back at biblical stories to kind of reflect on it? Or do they seem, I don't know, kind of like romance novels compared to the actuality of the digs?
I think that for the most part, those characters don't help us much with daily life. But what they do for us is help dispel the notion of women as passive figures. And Rebecca is anything but passive. There are some really interesting things about her. First of all, the chapter about Deborah and the so-called courtship of...
About Rebecca.
Oh.
You know, it's funny. There's not
women.
That many women, you know.
I'm popping in my head. Rebecca is in a chapter that's the longest chapter in the whole book of Genesis. It's like a short story in and of itself, the wooing of Rebecca. She's a very dynamic figure.
Whole thing's repeated twice, really. Yes.
You look up the verbs that are used about her, and they're all action verbs. And one of those verbs, the verb to go in Hebrew, is used seven times. And if you're listening to this, which most people in the ancient audience did, they couldn't read, you get to hear that word repeated over and over again. Now, seven times is a sacred Semitic number. So when something appears seven times, it's like saying, you go, girl, go. Rebecca is fully on the go, and she, in many ways, is in charge of her own destiny. She gets to choose whether she's going to follow this character, the Abraham's servant, to take her to this faraway, unknown place. When she finally does agree to do this, there's an amazing little verse that kind of repeats the same language that was said to Abraham about going to this faraway land,
the same kind of
and
thing, right?
Your seed will be as plentiful as the sand of the shore, and that repeats the language to Abraham. In other words, she's in many ways the most important character in the second generation of ancestors. You get Abraham and Sarah, and Abraham is a bit more prominent than Sarah, and then at the other end you get Jacob and his two wives and two handmaids, and certainly Jacob is the most important figure. But in the middle generation of Rebecca and Isaac, Rebecca dominates, and Isaac is kind of a pawn. She manipulates him to achieve what she wants to achieve. And I think that can tell you a lot about some prominent elite women in the ancient biblical world that they really did have a lot of managerial power in their households.
Fascinating. I want to thank Professor Carol Myers for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Tell us again the name of the book.
Rediscovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context, Oxford Unity Press, University Press, 2013.
Thank you again, Carol. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Professor Peter Machinis of Harvard, maybe the world's expert on the Book of Job. Our playout this morning in preparation for Passover tomorrow night comes from the irrepressible Doug Kotler singing his own version of a Pesach song, Wasting Away Again in Manischewitzville. My friends, a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher Passover, and a Zisen Pesach. May you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Nibbling on sponge cake, got such a headache. All of this matzah's starting to bind. Dying or singing until it's bringing bowls full of brisket. One more bite, I'll go blind. Wasting.